Want to hear one of my ideas for a perfect murder? You want to hear the busted light socket in the bathroom or the carbon monoxide in the garage?
Neither one. I may be old-fashioned, but I thought murder was against the law.
What is a life for two guys? Some people are better off dead. Like your wife and my father, for instance. Oh, that reminds me of a wonderful idea I had once. I used to put myself to sleep at night, figuring it out. Now, let's say that you'd like to get rid of your wife.
It's a morbid thought.
No. Just suppose. Let's say that you had a very good reason.
Let's say.
Now, you'd be afraid to kill her. You know why? You'd get caught. And what would trip you up? The motive. Ah, now, here's my idea.
I'm afraid I haven't got time to listen, Bruce.
Listen, it's so simple, too. Two fellows meet accidentally, like you and me. No connection between them at all. Never saw each other before. Each one has somebody that he'd like to get rid of. So, they swap murders.
Swap murders?
Each fellow does the other fellow's murder. Then there's nothing to connect them. Each one has murdered a total stranger. Like, you do my murder, I do yours.
We're coming into my station.
For example, your wife, my father. Crisscross.
What?
Oh, we do talk the same language, don't we?
Well, sure, Bruno, we talk the same language. Thanks for the lunch.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I thought the lamb chops were a little overdone myself.
Nice meeting you.
Now, you think my theory's okay, Guy? You like it?
Sure, Bruno, sure. They're all okay.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I'm your host, Jason Bishop, and of course with me today, as always, is Sam Stepanenko.
I am here, and I will not be getting on any trains anytime soon.
Really? Because I have this plan for a perfect murder. I don't know if you want to hear it.
Perfect murder? I don't think there's such a thing.
Well, he seemed to think so.
Well, he definitely seemed to think so. But he was nuts.
He was definitely nuts because, yeah, today we're going to be talking about the Alfred Hitchcock classic, Strangers on a Train, and we're going to do something a little different because Strangers on a Train was a very influential film, Strangers on a Train from 1951. It inspired lots of things. You've seen it on television shows and other films like Horrible Bosses and Sweet Revenge, and of course the one we're going to be talking about today and comparing to Strangers on a Train, Throw Mama from a Train from 1987, starring Billy Crystal.
Yeah, certainly it's not a straight-up remake, but there are definitely elements, and there's definitely an homage of epic proportions in this movie.
Well, yeah, they watch the movie.
Yes, they do, yeah.
Well, Owen does, anyway.
Yes. I'm not going to do the Owen voice, but I want to so bad, because I can't get Anne Ramsey's voice. That voice is something else. I mean, she was perfect in that role.
Yeah. You know, I don't think I ever saw a lot of Anne Ramsey films. She'd done a lot.
63, yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of curious. I'm like, I wouldn't mind visiting one of the earlier ones to see if she always was like that. Yeah. Or because, like, I know her from this and The Goonies, and I think there's one other one that I'd seen. I can only remember two or three I had actually seen over my lifetime. But she passed, I think, shortly after this one.
3 or 4 years after this one, yeah.
Yeah, not that shortly.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if she already had it, but I know that it was like a cancer of the throat of the tongue, which I think is why she started to sound like that later in life, is that she did have a problem with her throat and tongue. Because she did have sort of a speech impediment, coming from somebody who has one.
Sam Stepanenko, my editing nightmare.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, I do all right, all things considered, because I do have the occasional stutter. stutter.
So do I from time to time. So we all do it.
Yeah. Mine's fun.
Until I hit the editing room. No wonder you get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, I don't want to be here when you edit. No.
Son of a bitch!
Hey, I've edited myself, and I first thing I did after I did it was text you.
I'm a nightmare.
Actually, my words were, I'm a fucking nightmare to edit.
And then I, in all caps, text you back, I know.
Yes.
But you know what? We've never talked about Alfred Hitchcock before.
Surprisingly enough.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's not like there's a lot of remakes, and I wouldn't attempt to remake a Hitchcock film.
No, I don't think there's any really on the list I want to do. He has remade one of his own movies, yes. So we might do a comparison, which would be interesting to see him changing his own visions. And, of course, there's the Psycho remake, which we kind of keep saying we won't really do because it's a shot-for-shot remake, and still they managed to fuck it up.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's one that I'd prefer not to touch just because I've seen them both and... It's a waste of time to talk about them because there's nothing to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Except for how crappy the remake ended up being because there's nothing new in it. And there we go. That's our discussion on Psycho.
We've probably done it several times. Bonus, absolutely free Psycho review. Stranger Than a Train from 1951. Story behind this is, I mean, like most Hitchcock films, has a nice story behind it as well. Because Alfred Hitchcock... He went to get the rights to the novel by Patricia Highsmith.
Who we will be talking about again, because there's actually a movie by a book by her called Cry of the Owl. And I actually caught part of it accidentally at my mother-in-law's this week.
Oh.
So talk about weird connections.
Synchronicity or what?
Yeah. It was originally made as a foreign film, so I want to do it just because of that. Yeah. And then it was remade with Julia Stiles in 2007 or 8 or somewhere in there.
Oh.
But it was actually quite interesting. So, and then she also wrote The Talented Mr. Ripley.
There you go. So there's plenty of fodder there for us, I yes. think. Alfred Hitchcock, when he bid on the rights to the book, the film rights, he bid under a different name just so he could get it cheaper.
Really?
Yeah.
Smart.
Oh, this is Alfred as a whole. Like, just reading up on Alfred Hitchcock and what he was like with sets and stuff. Now, the studio, they always want to use some of their standard actors. 1951, they had contracted actors. And one of those was Ruth Roman, who plays Ann Morton. And Alfred wasn't having any of it. But this, you can read this. This story is almost identical on every film he's ever done. He's got to pick one. You're the one that I'm going to hate for the entire production and make your life a living hell.
Yeah, I kind of get the impression that Hitchcock was a bit of a dick.
Yeah. His daughter, Patricia, who is in this movie as well, they had made that fairground set. I think the only scene in the movie that wasn't shot on that set was the Tunnel of Love, which was in an actual fairground. Yeah. Otherwise, everything else had been built for this film. And she's terribly afraid of heights, so Alfred's like, hey, I'll give you $100 to go around the Ferris wheel.
On a set.
On a set. I mean, these are working things.
They brought in a real Ferris wheel
to
create the illusion of the... Okay.
Yeah, so reluctantly, she's like, okay, I want $100.
Yeah, especially 1951, that's
a fair chunk of change. Yeah. So she gets on top of the Ferris wheel. Once she's at the top, Alfred has the guy running the wheel shut it down in complete darkness for about 5-6 seconds or so, just to try to get, I don't know, in his mind he was probably trying to help her face her fears. Maybe. I'd like to think so. But more likely, it was just...
Because he thought it was funny.
He thought it was funny. Needless to say, she was traumatized and was not happy. And she didn't get paid.
Seriously?
She didn't get paid.
That's cold. And you know what? I will say that I really enjoyed her performance in this movie, too.
I thought she was pretty good.
Yeah. She was entertaining. She was kind of the humor, the humorous aspect of the movie for a lot of it, I found. She was really good at bringing that lightness into those moments when she was on screen.
Yeah, and she is also the kind of gateway to guilt for the murderer in this movie.
Yes.
When she was cast, like, to avoid that nepotism thing, they never talked about it when they weren't on set, and he treated her just like any other actor would criticize her performances, etc. So she got a lot of respect for that. And she did get to direct her father
in his brief
cameo. Did you catch it?
Yeah, with the cello, yeah.
Yeah, with the actually, I think it was a bass guitar. Was it a cello?
The cello,
bass? Yeah. Something like that. But yeah, he was getting on the train earlier in the film. To be honest, I almost missed it because, I mean, I'm much younger, slimmer Alfred than I'm used to seeing because I'm used to the later cameos.
Yes, where he's all tummy.
Yeah, yeah, he was a much more rotund man.
Yeah, he was robust.
Stranger on a Train. There was a lot of people involved in the script on this. The adaptation was written by Whitfield Cook. The screenplay is mainly credited to Raymond Chandler, who wrote a lot of the Marlowe novels, and lots of films have been based on his works. And this would actually be his last screenplay, because him and Alfred did not get along, and they were two extreme personalities, and Raymond being the heavy drinker and outspoken dude, he thought this was a silly little film to begin with. And wanted to concentrate more on characters and motive, where Alfred's was more about the set pieces and less about the dialogue. So there's lots of clashing in ideals. And eventually he would look for a new writer in Ben Hecht, who couldn't do it, but recommended his understudy, who'd never written a screenplay before. That was Senzi Ormond. This is pretty much her screenplay, but Raymond Chandler's name... Initially, Alfred wanted it removed, but he drew tickets. Yeah. I mean, it's Raymond Chandler.
And yeah, Ben Hecht, he does get recognized in IMDb as an uncredited screenwriter, so I'm guessing that he probably did some review of his understudy's work to make sure that she was on the right track. Mm-hmm. And there's a connection there, because he also has an uncredited screenwriting credit. That sounds odd, but that's what it is called, for Casino Royale.
Oh, see, there you go. There's a connection that I did not make, because if you're not credited in either film, I'm probably not looking you up.
Yes, it was just a fluke. I'm like, well, let's take a look, right? Because he's uncredited, and that's normally what I would normally not bother either. But I did, and yeah, he was...
So far, we've talked about him twice, and neither time did he actually get credited in the film.
He has a shit ton on his IMDb of uncredited screenwriting credits. Like, if you look at it, he's got a look at his IMDb is huge.
Yeah.
And it's like almost like every second one from about 1950 on is uncredited.
Jesus Christ. Hey, we got an idea. You want to, can I roll it by you? Yeah. Sure.
Do the treatment and just review our treatment and we'll pay you, right? Which is probably why it still shows up on his IMDb, because he did get paid somehow.
Yeah, it was probably some sort of script review.
Yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, that was episode 155, if you want to catch it.
Well done. I didn't catch that one. Of course, directed by Alfred Hitchcock and starring Farley Granger, who we first talked about in episode 186 just a couple weeks ago. Well, a little more than a couple weeks ago. About a month ago.
Yeah.
They Call Me Trinity.
Yeah, that was a pleasant surprise.
Mm-hmm. Robert Walker plays Bruno Antony, the murderer in this film. Sadly, he died shortly after making this film, about 8 months after this film was completed.
Just like a week after its release, he passed away. This is his penultimate role, because he did have one more that came out posthumously.
Yeah, which is a shame. He's a talented dude, and it was just allergies due to prescribed drugs that he had, and it was just one of those avoidable tragedies if people had been paying attention to what his allergies were.
Well, that and alcohol. I mean, he was quite inebriated when they gave him the medication.
Sounds like a combination then.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a very common tragic Hollywood death is the mixing of prescription medications and alcohol, or just the mixing of prescription medications.
Ruth Roman, who's the studio-appointed love interest, and Morton. You can see her in Great Day in the Morning. Leo G. Carroll was her father's Senator Morton. We actually did talk about him before.
I couldn't find it. I was sure we had, but I couldn't find it.
Episode 183, We're No Angels.
Oh, good Lord. I don't
fairly
know how I missed
recently.
That. Yes, fairly recently. We're seeing a lot of really recent connections in this one.
Yeah, it was just unintentionally, for sure. Patricia Hitchcock played Barbara Morton, and she's also in Psycho. And, of course, the daughter of Alfred. Actually the only living person remaining from this film.
Interesting.
As well. And also the only heir to Alfred's fortune. Casey Rogers was Miriam the main character's bitch wife.
Oh, wow. I really want to talk about her quite extensively, actually. Right? That's not her real name. That's her stage name. Mm-hmm. She took the name Casey because she was actually a really good softball player. And she hit the ball really well. So as a teen, they called her Casey from Casey at the Bat.
Right.
Right. And that's why she went with Casey as her stage name.
Oh, cool.
So. She was also quite prolific as an actress, but I couldn't see any connections to her.
Well, there's a kind of minor connection to another actress in here because she would later be a regular on the Bewitched TV series with Marion Lorne, who plays Mrs. Antony, who was also on the Bewitched TV show and was also in The Graduate.
Yeah, and this is one of her early film appearances. She had a really long stage career. And
yeah,
I
think, actually was her feature debut.
It may have been, yeah, I didn't check that. I knew it was early in her career, but I don't know how early, didn't know how early. But yeah, wonderful, wonderful performance by her too.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Hale was Mr. Antony. We'll probably mention him at some point because he was in one of the bazillion A Star Is Borns, but the 1937 one specifically, and was in a series of Saint movies as well. Howard St. John was the police Captain Turley. He's in a bunch of the Little Abner movies. John Brown was the drunk Professor Collins. And I just want to mention, because he was in a movie called The Robot Monster.
Nice.
And, of course, The Day Earth Stood Still, so we'll probably talk about him again at some point. And Norma Vardon was Mrs. Cunningham, and she was Frau Schmidt in Sound of Music.
Lots of connections to stuff that we haven't done yet.
Yeah, and Robert Gist was the detective, Leslie Hennessy, who's tailing Guy through most of the movie, and he's in A Miracle on 34th Street, which was his first role.
Lots of early performances from some actors in there.
Yeah, so, and it which seems a little out of character for Alfred to pick a bunch of people who don't have a lot of credits, but...
Again, it might be, like you said, studio contracts. It might be just budget. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he's trying to get the script on the cheap or the book, the rights to the book on the cheap, he may have just...
Yeah, it sounds like he was just cheap dude in general. But hey, speaking of budgets, this movie was budgeted at $1.2 million, which
still
is
pretty high for
1951. And it grossed $7.63 million in the U.S. Now, adjusted from 1951, just because that doesn't sound like a lot. But let's put it in 2019 standards. So the budget in 2019 would be about $11.8 million.
That's pretty reasonable.
That's pretty reasonable, considering he built a fairground.
Yeah.
So people were getting paid very well. The gross, just in the U.S. alone, would have been almost $75 million.
That's a good return.
That's a very good return.
Yeah, especially on a quirky little film like this. This isn't the type of film where you would get a huge audience today, because it's not a blockbuster. It's a smart thinking film, and there's a lot of dialogue, very little action happening.
Well, Alfred was coming off a string of bombs, to be honest. Yeah. Even though they've aged particularly well, things like Rope that came before did not perform well. So this was one of his first hits in quite a while, if not ever.
You always forget how far back Hitchcock's career goes, because it's like 1928, I think, was his first short film, and he moved right into features shortly thereafter. Right? So he's already 20 years into his career when he makes this movie.
Mm-hmm. It's very well established. You can see the craftsmanship as far as the shots and stuff goes. They're well thought out. He's often bored on set because he's got it so meticulously worked out.
Yeah, you can see a lot of his sort of trademark looks in this movie,
mm-hmm.
as far as the way it's shot and the way people are positioned in the frame.
Mm-hmm. There are some times where it's like there's a pretentiousness about it where, like, the Casey Rogers, who's had those big bottle cap glasses, the super thick glasses, like, she had no problem seeing. She was fine. So he effectively made her blind on set, and that's why she's always holding on to things to figure out where she is. she's got to be led, which is probably why she had two dates to the fairground.
Probably, yes.
So she didn't fall on her ass.
In case you haven't seen this movie, she is a slut. They say promiscuous in the synopsis, but she is a slut.
Alfred does some... he's very subtle in trying to get around censor boards. I mean, I think this is still a little before McCarthyism, where things really got stringent, but there's definitely things you couldn't say even in 1951. And there's, I mean, that character, it's fairly obvious what he's trying to say, but there's the homosexual undertones of Bruno. That's all kind of underlayered there without saying it outright, which is probably a better way of filming it anyway, because, you know, you're putting it out there, people know what you're getting at, but you're getting past the studios as far as that stuff.
They don't say it outright.
They don't say it outright, and it's subtle enough that if you're not paying attention, you might not see it.
Yeah, and that's one of the things they give Chandler credit for, is bringing that more forward without being overt about it, because it's really, really light in the book. Mm-hmm. It's there, but it's nowhere near as prominent as in the movie. And even the movie, it's really subtle.
Yeah.
Right? But it's definitely something that you can catch if you're paying attention.
Yeah, and if you want to pay attention, I'm going to run the trailer for the 1951. Remember last week when I was talking about 50s trailers having a lot of music? This is one of those fucking trailers.
Fellows meet, like you and I. No connection between them whatsoever. Each one has somebody that he'd like to get rid of. So, they swap murders.
Fantastic, isn't it? You didn't know when Bruno proposed this pact that he was serious. Dead serious. You had made the mistake of speaking to a stranger on a train. And now, wherever you go, whatever you do, you find yourself dominated by his evil presence. And you, Bruno, to you, killing was the answer. Murder without clue, without motive. The perfect crime. Too perfect. And Anne, life looked very attractive to you until the love in your heart became gripped by a terror that drew you deeper and deeper into this vortex of conspiracy.
I don't like to be double-crossed. I have a murder on my conscience, but it's not my murder, Mr. Haynes.
I wonder if you know how much I love you.
Brazen woman, I'm the one to say that.
Strangers on a Train. So let's get into this. You know what? I didn't really like this movie. I really wanted to. I was looking forward to it. I grabbed my Alfred Hitchcock collection, and then I was already bitter when it wasn't in it.
Yes. I got a text.
I got this big Alfred Hitchcock collection, and finally get to dive into it, and what's not in it? Strangers on a Train.
The one that you need to watch.
I'm like, son of a bitch.
You know, it's funny because Val came down. She's been busy doing some other things, so she didn't get a chance to watch it with me. But she came down about 10 minutes before the end, and she says, "I'm really sorry I didn't get to watch this with you." And I said, "It's okay. It's fucking boring."
Mm-hmm.
It is. It's so paced. It's paced so slow for even for a Hitchcock film. The pacing is so slow and plodding. And I understand what they're trying to do, but by today's standards, it just doesn't stand up the way I expected it.
No, it doesn't age as well as maybe some of the other Hitchcock films. It's certainly a classic, and there's lots to like about this from a filmmaker point of view.
Yeah, and
sure,
the story's still entertaining. It just felt plodding. They could have knocked about 10 minutes off.
And there's a bit of silliness that I would have thought would have been silly even in 1951. I mean, if you're planning a murder of your father and you want to do this perfect murder, you're stalking your favorite tennis star, And, like, this dude tells everybody about his perfect murder plan of crisscross.
Yes.
I'll do your murder and you do mine. And this tennis star is having issues with his wife, who he wants a divorce from, who's been cheating on him.
And is pregnant with another man's child.
Pregnant with another man's child. He's already met somebody else he's very fond of and would like to move forward.
And whose family is very fond of him.
Yeah. And so he just wants out. And then she sees money. Now, like, his tennis career is taking off, and there's, like, endorsements and celebrity stuff. Like,
and she's a malicious bitch, since she doesn't want him to be happy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, needless to say, he's kind of angry about her, too. And he even made a public scene where...
Which fits into the movie really well.
It does, because he's seen kind of holding her, looking like he's kind of strangling her, but it's more of a shake.
Yeah. But he's being physical with her.
He's being physical, and... He's yelling things like, I want you dead. Yeah. Like, why don't you just die?
I could just strangle her.
I could just strangle her.
Coincidentally, is how she ends up dying. She does get strangled to death.
Yeah, there's one movie poster with Alfred Hitchcock holding up an L into the Strangers part of the logo to make it Stranglers.
Nice. I'm going to look for that.
Yeah, I got to find that, too. That might be a good one to use as part of the image for this episode.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. This one has some really great images, like the posters. When I was looking for information on it, some of the posters look really cool. So we could have some fun with the...
I love 50s posters in general. They're really cool.
And they're really easy to work with, too.
Yeah, so there's a kind of a nice setup there, because, sure, he's going to be a suspect in his wife's murder. And, of course, the only alibi he had at the time of the murder was this drunk professor on a train that he talked about, who didn't remember him.
Well, and I like the way that they sort of translated that over to the throw mama from the train. But in both cases, the killer who's doing this stuff forgets to take into account alibi.
Yeah. Right?
And making sure that his alibi is alibied.
Yeah.
Right, because Billy Crystal is bemoaning his fate on a beach all by himself the whole time that his ex-wife is getting quote unquote murdered.
Yeah,
right, and so you have sort of a conjunction there, and so they keep those key beats in this loosely inspired comedy.
Yeah, thankfully, Guy Haines, Farley Granger in this movie, wasn't nearly as whiny as Billy Crystal about his life.
No, he was not. And I'll be honest with you, Throw Mama was painful to watch. I remember liking it when I saw it in like late 80s.
I'd seen it once. I thought I liked it, but the fact that I never rewatched it probably says a lot.
Being Billy Crystal fans, but yeah. As I watched it, I'm like, this is Billy Crystal. All of the characters are kind of fucking whiny.
Well, yeah. This one you just wanted to slap.
Yeah, he's really, really a whiny little bitch in this.
Yeah, he totally was.
And they make a point of pointing that out. There's a couple scenes there where he's bemoaning complaining about his ex-wife, and some guy says something to him about it. Says, this is the fifth time you've said this, right? He's got to stop.
Yeah, well, and I don't know why Kim Greist was still interested in him. And I'm like,
what is he giving to be interested in? He's a whiny bitch.
He's a whiny bitch who's constantly talking about his ex with the girl he kind of wants to get with. So, like, yeah, that's really attractive.
Yeah. Right, and I mean, he wasn't whining so much about his wife in the sense that he missed her in any way. It's just because she...
Fucked him over.
She fucked him over. She stole his story idea and became famous as a result.
Yeah. Right?
But at the same time, he is an unsuccessful writer. He is not good at writing at this point in his career.
No, well, his hang-ups about his ex-wife are what gives him writer's block.
Yes.
I love the joke, though, where... they're trying to make out, and it's like, well, I can't. I have writer's block everywhere.
Yes. Yeah, that was a good line. Actually, Kim Greist is one of the finer points of this film, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, her performance, who didn't really have a big career, her body of work is quite small. She delivers every time you see her on screen.
Yeah. No, she certainly stood out in the few times she was on screen. I mean, she's fairly prominent in there, but she doesn't really drive the story forward.
No, and she doesn't in any of the other movies that we've seen her in.
Yeah. Just a love interest.
Yeah. Like every other movie we've seen her in. But she delivers in all of them.
Yeah. So But back to Strangers on a Train.
Yes.
If you don't know how that one goes, there's the whole Bruno brings up his perfect murder crisscross bit. And in his brain, that was like a conversation that we agreed upon. Let's do this thing. Come on.
Yeah, this, which again translates to
this wasn't theory, this is planned.
Yeah,
and he's mentally ill.
He's mentally ill, and that's one of the differences between Anthony and Bruno and Owen. Is Owen's not mentally ill, he's desperate, and he's not very bright.
Yeah.
Right? He's very much childlike, and he mistakes what Larry says to him as being an agreement.
Yeah.
Right? And he's never really tells Larry what the plan actually is. If you're paying attention, he's just keeps going crisscross, right? He says, I'll take care of yours, you take care of mine, right? Without really outright stating it.
Yeah, he's almost assuming that they were at the movies together when they weren't.
Yes, right. Just because Larry told him he should watch Strangers on a Train to sort of learn how to tell the story.
Yeah, because of motive, and if you're writing a murder mystery, you need to take the alibi away.
Yes.
That was one of the things he was trying to teach.
Yes, and it's a great example of how it's done wrong. Because it is done wrong. If you're paying attention, this is not a good example of how to commit a murder. This is the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's so many mistakes that Anthony makes that ultimately do put Guy in the spotlight, but at the same time, in the end, exonerate him.
Yeah, well, I mean, that one little bit where Guy lends Bruno his lighter and doesn't get it back.
Yes.
So that's evidence that can be planted.
Which was dropped and was laying in the grass at the time of the murder, but
at the time, he didn't want to implicate his buddy because, like, I'm doing your murder, you're doing mine, and crisscross.
Exactly. Right.
But it's a failsafe for him later on because he never breaks his story.
No, he never does break his story. Even at his dying breath, he never breaks his story.
No. No, it's only when the evidence plummets out of his hand.
Yes. And the interesting thing about this story is the fact that, and it happens in both movies, where he defeats his own purpose by continually being in contact with Guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the whole idea was, it's like, you do your murder, and then you're done, and there's no connection between the two of you.
Yeah.
He keeps creating this connection.
Yeah, I mean, Guy's been questioned already about the murder of his wife, and he's being tailed by the cops, who haven't been able to make any evidence to stick on him at all. They, like, okay, he's a person of interest, but right now,
We don't have any evidence on him, but even though
his alibi is a little weak, but by all accounts, he didn't do this.
Yeah.
And then along comes this guy. Well, how do you know Bruno?
Yeah.
And, you know, who's constantly pushing, inserting himself into Guy's life. He's trying to get Guy to hold up his end of a deal that he never agreed to.
Yes. Yeah. Right. And to the point of giving him a map and a key and a gun.
Yeah.
It's like, and everything that he does just creates more of a connection.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's like he lost the plot of his own plot.
Mm-hmm.
He could have been more subtle about it, but he's crazy. Right.
Yeah. I mean, Guy at one point dodges his tails to go to the house with the key and the gun.
To warn the guy's father.
To warn the guy's father, which is a very similar scene to when Billy Crystal tries to warn Mama.
Yes.
Owen's mama.
To a completely different effect.
To a completely different effect, yes.
Yeah, Billy Crystal wakes up on the floor a lot during that section of the film.
Well, Owen wasn't waiting to find out what was happening. Like, there's Bruno in his father's bed.
Yes.
Waiting for Guy.
Somewhat creepy.
Yeah. He's creepy. He's absolutely creepy. And it's a very similar character to the one we see in Psycho.
Very similar, yes.
You know, a more softer character, but really ominous. I love the tennis match. I love, love, love the tennis match. Well, the first time Bruno's at the tennis match and everybody's watching the ball and their heads are going back and forth and back and forth in this cartoon manner. It's hilarious. But
his eyes never.
Yeah, Bruno's never leave Guy.
Yeah. Again, there are all these aspects that make Hitchcock's filmmaking the masterpieces that they usually are.
Yeah.
And I mean, this one is rated really highly, and people are going to disagree with this and say, well, no, it's a great film. But if you watch it Carefully, it's not as great as you might think it is.
Yeah, like I'm with Raymond Chandler on this one. It's a silly little film. Yeah. It doesn't. I mean, in my mind, the whole thing doesn't really work. Like, I mean, Bruno's telling everybody about his perfect murder scenario. Everybody. I mean, that first conversation, he's like, I used to put myself to sleep with these ideas of murder. I'm like, okay, psycho.
Yes. And there's that scene where he chokes out that lady at the party.
Granted, that was his own guilt. This is after he's killed Miriam. And Patricia Hitchcock, her character Barbara Morton, has similar glasses and a similar height to Miriam, so it reminds him of the moment, and he gets lost in his head.
Yeah.
Either through guilt or just that moment relives in his brain when he sees her. And this certainly unsettles Barbara as well.
Well, it does, and I mean, this is where he should have been arrested, because regardless of his motivation, it's assault.
Yeah.
It's attempted fucking murder.
Great. It was a conversation they were having, and she's like, oh, yes, let me see how you would do it.
Yes. I mean, she gave him permission to lay his hands on her neck.
But he should have been arrested.
But he should have been arrested.
And this was a party that guy was at, and cops would have been very close.
Yes.
They were just outside.
Exactly. So one of the flaws in the film, and a lot of these things that they do to create tension don't flow as well as I had hoped, and didn't create tension for me, except for the final tennis match. I got tense there.
Mm.
Right? The final tennis match where he has to win it in three sets, and that worked.
Yeah, because, I mean, has this obligation to this match for this big tennis thing, and by this point, Bruno's like, all right, you're not doing my murder, you're going down for yours.
Yeah.
And he's going to plant the evidence back at the murder scene. It's folly after folly as he's trying to get back to the fairgrounds.
Yes, the whole thing with dropping the lighter down the storm drain.
He's got really stretchy arms.
He does.
And thin.
And very thin, because I mean, I'm skinny. There's no way I could have got my arm down that far down into the...
No.
Into that storm drain. And I mean, there are enough people that they could have lifted it off.
I know. All the people fascinated with this guy trying to get the cigarette lighter. Mm. Like, wow, how boring were the 1950s that this was a big scene.
Well, and yeah, that's another example of a scene that didn't really work for me in this movie.
I mean, but granted, Bruno was making a scene as well.
Yeah, he was. And I mean, it was kind of...
If he couldn't get it, and if it washed away, everything was done.
Yes. Yeah, there's no way that he can essentially frame Guy for the murder.
Yeah, unless he still had the broken glasses and planted it at Bruno's apartment, which he didn't, because he gave them to Bruno. Bruno actually had them.
Or Guy actually had them.
Guy actually had them, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and that, which is also very odd. I mean, you know, because again, he keeps creating these connections.
Yeah.
Right? Instead
of... Why did you give the broken glasses... I mean, maybe it was evidence of the murder of Miriam. So, I did this. But now you're planting evidence of the murder onto the guy who's not supposed to have evidence of the murder.
Yes. It shows the level of Bruno's obsession is...
It's not as well thought out as he thinks it is.
Well, that's exactly it. Is he keeps defeating his own purpose.
Yeah.
Right? He keeps establishing these connections. But at the same time, I think he's trying to get leverage on Guy to get Guy to do what he wants Guy to do.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
Because... I think he knows that Guy doesn't really want to do it and has no intention of doing it, right from the get-go. He knows that that he never really obtained agreement, right? So now he's trying to bully him into doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's obsessed with Guy in his own weird way. And we talked about the homoerotic undertones and all that. But
oh, yeah, he knew everything about Guy.
Yeah. In trying to bully Guy into doing what he wants, I keep saying it, but he undercuts the intent of his own murder plots.
Mm.
Right, because he keeps establishing that fucking connection.
No, I mean, he's not that smart, but he's certainly scary in his obsession.
Yes, and I mean, he is intelligent, but his obsession defeats his intelligence, which is quite common, right? Is somebody can be highly intelligent and they get obsessed with something, and it becomes so overpowering that your intellect gets overwhelmed by the obsession.
Yeah. Right?
And that's what's happened to him.
Yeah. Now, with Guy, like, he's pretty honest with Anne really early on of what's going on. Initially, she's seeing signs of weirdness, especially when she starts meeting Bruno.
Yes.
Like, okay, what's up with this dude? Like, something's up here and he's got something on you.
Yeah, and he makes me uncomfortable.
Makes me uncomfortable. And then Guy spills, and the first thing out of her mouth was, how did you get him to do it?
Yes. Like,
she actually thought
that he had manipulated it, Bruno into doing the murder, whereas Bruno had volunteered and was trying to manipulate Guy into doing the murder.
Yeah.
And that's the other flaw in the movie is to me the way that whole bit is handled, mm-hmm. right, is it throws the suspicion back onto Guy, even from the people who are closest to him.
Yeah, well,
do that in Throw Mama as well.
Yeah, that is the gist of this movie, is like he's constantly under that suspicious umbrella and trying to get out from under it. Even the people closest to him are suspecting that he may have actually done this terrible deed, which is unfortunate. Thankfully, her belief in him overrides that thought fairly quickly.
Very quickly, yeah.
Yeah, and something similar happens with Beth as well.
Yes, it does. I was just about to mention that. The interesting thing about Throw Mama, though, is he goes to her for help and she freaks out and chases him away, giving him no recourse except to go to Owen,
mm-hmm.
right? Which sets up the last act of the film.
At least that makes somewhat a sense. I mean, with Anne in the original film here, there was an established relationship that had been going on, like, I think, for quite a while, and a real love there, where, I mean, this was early days of, if we've been on a date, a single date, and you're telling me this shit.
Yes. Well, I mean, they've been out more than that, but their dates keep getting interrupted.
Yeah.
Right? And they haven't really had a successful date. Or have they? I can't remember. I think they actually have been, they have moved on to the point of intimacy by this point.
Well, but, I mean, there was the kid train, which was kind of an interesting homage.
Yeah.
To the original film, where they're making out on the train, and that was the whole writer's block all over bit.
Yes.
Well, meanwhile, just a couple cars down, there's Owen munching on a bag of chips watching the show.
extremely uncomfortable. and it worked. Like, they're
a creepy little stalker dude, too.
Yes. And it's also, not only is it an homage to the train, itself an homage, but the fact that it's in a public place is also a nod to the island, because the island is where young people go to mess around.
Yeah.
Right. They talk about that at the beginning of the movie, when they first go to the island there, that it's where people go to do things they probably shouldn't be doing.
Yeah. Miriam was definitely into the threesome.
Yeah. She was. Wow. I mean, you always forget that.
I'm like, Alfred, you're risque.
Yeah. I mean, cause you don't see, I don't recall seeing a lot of that type of sort of honesty in movies from the 50s. Right.
Yeah. I mean, they certainly allude to the fact that, oh man, she's getting both holes filled.
Yeah, she's up for a party. But kudos to Hitchcock for acknowledging that even though the 50s were kind of proper and there were sort of unspoken rules, right, that you don't talk about this type of thing, mm-hmm. people were having sex out of wedlock, having fun having sex, even in the 50s.
Yes.
Right. So get over it. Right. In her case, it led to her death. So get over it.
Which, you know, that is the message that even moved into slashers, is promiscuous sex will get you killed.
Yes. And maybe another thing that Hitchcock is responsible for influencing in modern horror, to be honest with you.
Oh, I mean, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, Psycho.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly it's definitely a theme in Hitchcock films about proper behavior will keep you alive. Because Guy's proper all the way through the movie. That's a good point, and sort of a juxtaposition. Is Guy sticks to his guns. He's considerate. He follows all the rules, mm-hmm. and he's still in trouble. But in the end, it exonerates him, which is, I think, the important part of that story.
Yeah, it's only because Bruno kept unsuccessfully planting evidence.
Yes.
Delayed with at the grate for quite some time, and then the crowds, the daylight, and then ultimately the ride handler who recognizes him.
Yes, and one thing made me nuts. When the cop accidentally shoots the carousel operator.
Yes, and then we got the carousel that goes insane.
Yes.
It is bonkers. It is silly as fuck, but
it's a fun ride. Pardon the pun, but
it is fun as hell. You know, the IMDb says only three people died in this movie.
I think there's at least a fourth, because the guy who's under that carousel, he ain't alive. There's no fucking way.
Well, he was in the middle of it when it blew up. So yeah. But that was a crazy stunt. Like, and Alfred said, "I'm never letting anybody do this again." And he was surprised somebody talked him into this. But that was a real guy crawling under a real
a real carousel
to get underneath and to the controls. I'm like, whoa, that's terrifying just to know that.
Yes.
I mean, the explosion and stuff was all done in miniature and then projected behind them and done really well, mind you. But you think about all the people that are on the carousel, the few that flew off are probably bruised up and hurt a little bit, but ultimately alive. But there were probably kids and stuff still on that thing when it blew up.
Yes.
And the only person they look for is Bruno.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's lifting up these horses and seeing if anybody else is underneath.
Or the operator who got shot, is he still alive?
Is he still alive? Well, ultimately, I'm guessing no.
He goes down pretty hard, pretty fast.
Yeah.
Like, craziness.
And what cop shoots into a Ferris wheel full of children?
One of the things that makes me feel like this movie is maybe receives just a smidge more love than it actually deserves, because there are all these storytelling flaws. It looks gorgeous, don't get me wrong, and the core story is interesting and entertaining, but there's so many things that Hitchcock obviously learned how to do better when it came to his storytelling.
I mean, this had been probably a great thriller in 1951.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And I still found it entertaining at times for maybe the wrong reasons. But, I mean, I thought Miriam's bottle cap glasses were hilarious, only to motivate that reflective strangling shot.
Yes.
Within the glasses. That was all that was there for.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't even swap out the glasses on the long shots.
So they make her suffer through it, yeah.
Yeah, so he's just sadistic bastard, Alfred Hitchcock was. But there are times where it's like, okay, sometimes you forsake a good scene just for a one shot. He's a little too precious about those shots. It's a great shot.
Oh, for sure.
And they had to make a whole new camera lens for it just so they could film it at 90 degrees and get that reflection proper. There was another shot because the lenses at the time didn't have the depth of field that lenses now have. So they're at the Mortons and the phone rings and Barbara's grabbing for it, and they wanted to keep the women in focus in the background and then the phone in the foreground also in focus. Problem is, the depth of field couldn't support that, so Alfred just made an oversized phone, and then when the camera operator swoops in, a grip just swaps it out for a regular phone, so it doesn't look like she's picking up a giant fucking phone.
Yeah, and it looks good. I mean, there's many shots.
It's a great cheat.
Right. And I mean, it's still used today. It's that the perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jackson used it in The Hobbit.
Yeah, forced perspective.
Yeah, he may not have even invented it, but he certainly popularized it.
Mm-hmm. So it was a great trick for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know what? Let's run the trailer for Throw Mama from a Train, and let's move our focus over there.
Let's.
Oh, you've got to get it through your thick head. I may be a lot of things, but I am not a killer.
You don't have to blow her brains out or anything.
Thank you. That takes the pressure right off.
She's old. She's got a bad ticker. All you gotta do is jerk around a lot when you talk to her. Nice to meet you, Mrs. Lifts.
Stop it. Evan, what the hell's going on out there?
We woke her up. Nothing, Mama.
Who's this?
This is Cousin Patty. He's gonna be staying with us for a while. Isn't that nice?
You don't have a cousin, Patty.
You lied to me.
Throw Mama from a Train from 1987, written by Stu Silver, who wrote plenty of episodes of Soap, which is a nice connection back to Billy Crystal,
yes,
and created Webster. I know, we're old.
Yes.
I remember Webster.
Oh, I certainly remember Webster.
I liked Webster. Was that the spinoff of Silver Spoons, or was it the other way around? I think it was the other way around. I think Silver Spoons was a spinoff of Webster.
I don't recall, but they were connected somehow.
Yeah. Budgeted at $14 million. It did fairly well in the U.S. and making almost $58 million.
That's
at the
not
box
bad.
Office. I mean, Billy Crystal was definitely a big commodity at the time.
Well, this is sort of the start of him becoming a bit of a commodity, because it was still fairly early in his film career. He'd been a regular on Soap and on SNL and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, maybe a hot item. Yeah. Like you could see stardom here.
Yes.
And they were definitely trying to make that happen. Despite kind of a, I don't know, what I think is a mediocre comedy at best, it did well.
Yeah.
Did well enough. It certainly didn't derail his career at all. Huh? Get it?
Yeah. Well done.
Thank you. It was directed and starred Danny DeVito, who we last talked about in episode 178.
Last Action Hero.
Last Action Hero. Correct.
That was not the one I thought you were going to miss.
Oh.
He was also in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh.
Episode 54.
Well, that was a case of I didn't have room to write down two.
That was okay. I'll give you that.
Okay. Billy Crystal, we of course talked about in episode 149, Running Scared, which we all loved, and you should definitely listen to that episode. Kim Greist, we've talked about a couple times.
Yes, we have.
We talked about her in episode 99, Manhunter, and episode 162.
Chud.
That was a good episode.
It was a good episode. And and we were talking about how much she owns the screen when she's on it. Even in that shitty film, she was good.
Hey, I love Chud. Fuck off.
I didn't say I didn't love it. It's still a shitty film.
It is a shitty film that I love.
Yes.
Anne Ramsey's obviously most famous for being in The Goonies. Everybody loves The Goonies. And we've never talked about her before. No. It was nice to pull up this kind of 80s icon.
Yes.
Kate Mulgrew, who we just talked about
last week. Yeah.
Was in 189, Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins.
Yeah, and I suspect that's probably like when we were figuring out what we were going to do for this week, and I threw out Throw Mama from the Train.
I think Sean even mentions it in the episode.
Possibly, and I just sort of stuck in my head, and I didn't make the connection until I started watching. I'm like, oh, fuck, I know why I recommended this or suggested this one.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a...
She plays Margaret, the also bitch, slutty wife.
Yes, the ex-wife, and she is slutty and really bitchy.
Yes.
She is so good at really bitchy.
Yes. It was weird seeing Branford Marsalis in this, though, as somebody who's more famous for being the band leader on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno than more than anything else. He's definitely more famous for his music than his acting abilities. And watching this, you can see why.
Yes. I mean, you could tell he was having fun.
Oh,
He wasn't good, but he was having fun.
He wasn't good. Yeah. He was definitely watchable because you could see he was enjoying himself.
Yeah. I mean, he has a certain charisma, even though his delivery may not have been ideal. He still has a sort of a charisma and presence on screen.
Yeah, I think so, too. Rob Reiner makes cameo appearance in this, and if you don't know the name Rob Reiner, then the hell with you.
Meathead,
yes, All in the Family. That's where it starts.
Yeah.
And a huge career after that. Bruce Kirby is the detective in this. You can see him in Stand By Me and Crash. Joey DePinto is the sergeant, and a very similar movie. I always associate these two movies together. He was in Stop or My Mom Will Shoot.
Yeah, you're right. There is a sort of commonality there. I mean, they're both very different films, but at the same time, there's...
But I have always associated these two films together. They're almost interchangeable in my brain as mediocre comedies with moms.
When I thought about the fact that Danny DeVito directed this, and this I think is his first feature film that he directed, this comedy is kind of dark. Right.
It is dark, but he's so broad with his directing choices that it kind of undermines whatever tone he's trying to do.
Yeah.
So the comedic beats don't really fire because of the underlying darkness, but the darkness doesn't really come out to play either. He's hitting the broad notes.
Yeah, he finally fine-tuned it in War of the Roses, right? You can tell he kind of leans towards that dark comedy because War of the Roses is brilliant. When you sort of see his growth from this to that.
To be honest, I almost think if he'd played his character a little straighter, a little smarter, I think this would have been a better film.
Make him more Bruno-like and less Owen-like.
Yeah. It was just... It really slowed down the pacing of the film for me. Annie Ross was a minor character in this movie. We talked about her in The Beast Must Die, episode 133.
How about that? That one I missed.
Ray Burke was also in this as Pinsky. He's in Naked Guns 1 and 3, which gives you an idea of the comedy stylings that he prefers to go to in his career. Oprah Winfrey cameos as herself. Olivia Brown, who's Mrs. Gladstone, was in 48 Hours. And Philip Perlman was, I just want to mention because he plays a character called Mr. Perlman. So lazy, they just called him who he was.
Now, Mr. Perlman, he's the one with the book about the women he wants to
What
does he call it? The Women I Want to Screw?
Yeah. Which he gets published.
Which gets published as a coffee table book, as he intended.
Ideally, I mean, that would have been a more modern book because list books do really well now.
Yes. That whole scene was... I mean, it was funny in the context of the scene because he's talking about writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the joke could have ended there.
Yeah.
And I don't think you needed to see him be successfully producing this misogynistic book.
Yeah. You know, the thing I most remembered about this movie, because I'd seen it only once prior, and I'd forgotten about Danny DeVito, I'd forgotten about Billy Crystal, I hadn't forgotten about Anne Ramsey. She makes your presence known when she's on screen.
Yes.
But the only thing I could remember was the night was... humid.
Yes.
Humid. Was it moist? Was it humid or moist?
And I think it's hilarious when Anne Ramsey, when Mama goes, sultry.
Sultry. And then that throws him in the death rage. I'm going to murder. I'm going to kill the bitch.
Yeah.
Hey, where are you going? I'm going to go kill your mom. Do you want anything?
Yeah, that's the best part of the movie, is the scene inside their house.
Yeah.
I think that's where DeVito really hit all the notes on the head.
There are some nice moments, like when he pulls out the worthless coin collection. But they are a collection of memories for him. Yes. About his father. We don't see the father. We know he's out of the picture, and he loved his father dearly.
Yes. Well, his father was kind to him. His mother's oppressive.
Yeah.
She's needy. She's mean. She's cruel. She's awful. She is truly awful. And her betrayal is really what's important to the film, because it's what motivates Crystal to go, you know what? I don't like this woman. I think I want to kill her myself. It has nothing to do with what Owen's desires are anymore.
Yeah.
I fucking hate her and I'm going to kill her anyhow.
Yeah. I like how you described her, because I wrote it down very similarly. Mama is abusive, selfish, and possessive.
Yes. Yeah. She's horrible. It's like just truly a horrible, horrible woman.
Yeah. But still loves Owen. Like,
in her weird way, yes.
In a weird way. She's not violently abusive. She might smack him over the head or whatever, but
she's verbally abusive.
Very verbally abusive. Yeah. But then she gives him these like gigantic cuddles that are like, okay, get away from me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's there's a weird duality there, because yeah, she has these moments of affection, you're right, but then instantly after it's like, you're trying to get rid of me, you're trying to put me in a home. And that's a theme throughout it, is she's terribly afraid of being abandoned by Owen.
Yeah, she's definitely got abandonment issues, and I think that stems from the father passing away early. Some mental instability there as well.
Yes, and I think that carries through to Owen as well in a different way.
Yeah, right. I mean, this essentially is the father character from the Strangers on a Train, who's also very abusive to Bruno. In his dialogue.
In his dialogue.
He's dismissive as well. Like, he just...
He's disappointed in Bruno.
Yeah, he's disappointed in Bruno. Doesn't think he's going to make himself...
Bruno's a fucking waste of skin.
Yeah.
I mean, he right at the beginning of the movie, when he first meets Guy, he says, I admire people who do things. I don't do anything.
Yeah. And that line kind of comes back into this movie here, when Branford Marsalis Lester is being interviewed by the police about Margaret going missing, and says, well, Larry couldn't have done it. He's never done anything.
Yeah. He literally doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great throwback to the original movie. And there's lots of those little moments, right? And they're subtle.
Yeah. There's subtle, and then there's not so subtle. Yeah. I mean, watching the actual movie within the movie.
Yeah.
Not so subtle.
Yeah. That was the, hey, you, just in case you don't fucking get it moment.
Yeah. But there are lots of those little Easter eggs as well that are quite nice.
Yes. And you know what would have been really nice is, considering that Strangers on a Train is based on a book, is if they had especially with Larry being a writer, he should have told Owen to read the book, right? But then Owen, being Owen, goes and watches the movie.
Yes.
That would have been funnier.
Yes.
Now I'm remaking a remake. Damn it.
We do it all the time. So basically in this movie, Owen is a student of Larry's in writing class. And these are just the most ungifted writers ever, but they all seem to get published.
Yes.
And just probably making poor Larry more nuts because he's been pining for 4 years, about four years, about his ex-wife who stole his manuscript and sold it as a book and got really famous.
Well, she stole his idea, and I think she did write it herself.
Right.
But she took the core of his idea and became successful with it.
Well, he does say she can't write herself out of a paper bag, so I was getting the assumption she just stole it. Because he does say, I wrote that. That's mine.
Yeah.
You know that. He tells his agent, who was Rob Reiner.
Who fires him
because,
signed his ex-wife.
And signed the ex-wife. Well, she sells books. You don't.
Wrote a book. You haven't.
You haven't. I agent authors, not artists.
Yes. yes. I mean, to be fair, Larry keeps getting kicked when he's down, right?
Yeah.
But he's got all these things that should be lifting him up. He's got Kim Grease's character. He's got the new girlfriend. He's got a job teaching people how to write. He clearly understands how to write, but I don't. And I like the way they made fun of the bad opening lines because the night was humid, the night was moist, the night was sultry. Books never start that way.
No,
that's a classic example of bad writing.
Yeah.
So I like the way that they kept focusing on that bad writing. It's like
and then when he finally gets to the point, the night was, he's terrible, like, the night was, and then he finally gets, the night was humid, and then Owen puts it in his.
Yes. Yes, another breaking point for him.
Yeah.
But I like the way Owen sort of keeps popping up on Larry, just like Bruno does in the original.
Mm-hmm.
Different circumstances, obviously, and more to it, sort of like that comedic effect, but also to Larry's great annoyance. It's for the first half of the movie, every time Owen shows up, Larry's just annoyed, right?
Yeah.
Unlike Guy, who's getting more and more uncomfortable
yeah.
because of the pressure that's being put on him.
Yeah, and then there's Owen, who doesn't pick up on social cues at all.
No.
But it also has that very public moment. This was in the cafeteria of the school, mind you, but with Beth, but when he has that freak out a moment about his ex-wife and says, like, it just kill her.
Yeah. I wish she was dead.
And yeah. that's also planting the roots of the idea within Owen's head, who actually goes to Hawaii.
And books a plane ticket under Larry's name, which baffled me. It was funny.
Yeah.
There's a plane ticket in my name.
Yeah. So even though he could place himself, I was like, okay, I was here. And then when he interrupts Lester post-coitus and his girlfriend there, that was Mrs. Gladstone, and she's like, well, wait a minute. You were here, you feasibly could have flown into Hawaii and come back in that time and just completely deconstructs the alibi.
Yes. Yeah, which was funny. There's some really great dialogue writing there to sort of tell the story and make Billy Crystal's character or make Larry that much more afraid of what's going to happen.
Yeah, and it's just Owen's ineptitude that kind of leaves the evidence trail.
Yes.
Now what really happens is she's banging the gardener. She runs off to go on a boat to Hawaii, I think.
Yeah, taking a ferry from one island to another.
And she's obsessed with her diamond earrings, and one of them fell off rear over the edge.
Which is the throwback to the lighter.
Yeah. And she's reaching over, and then we cut back to Larry. So we're not sure, but Owen's taking credit for her going overboard. And I love the bit where he's like, goes to push her, and then her ass is up in the air, and his hands kind of change position. Yeah. Like, all right.
You're making it easy for me.
Yeah. So did he do anything at all or not? We don't know. That's part of the thing about the movie.
Yes.
But there's such an underlying innocence. I don't think that you ever really believe Owen when he says he had done it.
Because she was situated so that it could have so easily been an accident, right?
Yeah, just taking credit for an accident.
Yeah. But it also sets up the whole the whole story is her death one way or the other, or disappearance in this case at this point, fills the whole rest of the story out. Mm-hmm. Right? Now Billy Crystal's under suspicion for the disappearance of his ex-wife.
Yeah. In fact, one of the best devices, I think, in this movie that work actually quite well are the Owen's dream sequences of killing his yes. mother. And I wish they'd done it a few more times, because they're the only times I feel like things are really working.
Yes. And again, this sort of shows where Danny DeVito really excels in directing, is that darkness, right? Because this mm-hmm. is this is a really dark humor.
This is
fantasizing about the murder of your mother, right?
Yeah.
And it's, but at the same time, it's very comedic. Right? There's the lie, and then there's the one you were just pointing
out. Yeah, the lie and the tea.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the scissors stabbed through her head.
Yeah.
Through her ear.
Yes, which
is. Owen!
Yes, nobody can do Owen like Anne Ramsey.
I'm not even going to try.
No.
Well, I guess I kind of tried. But I didn't really try.
It was just a.
No, I would hurt my throat doing that.
Probably, yes.
Something would rupture, for sure.
But yeah, I mean, all of the right themes are there, because, I mean, Owen keeps undermining his own plot mm-hmm. through ineptitude wholly through ineptitude, right? And trying to pressure mm-hmm. Larry into completing mm-hmm. his side of the deal. That was never a deal.
Yeah. And I mean, it's weird that he goes to Beth with a relationship that's barely working as it is, and she's like, how could you do this? Like, and it's lines like, one little murder and I'm Jack the Ripper.
Yes.
It's lines like that to don't help your case, Larry.
Yeah, exactly. My issue with both these movies is the easiest out is you go to the police right away and say, hey, this dude
is claiming to have killed my wife.
I know him. I met him on a train, or he's a student of mine, mm-hmm. and he suggested to me, and I didn't agree to this because I'm a moral human being. However,
he has an expectation.
He now has an expectation. He's now putting pressure on me to commit a murder.
Which would at least get them investigating.
Exactly.
Billy Crystal would still be a person of interest in the murder that makes most sense that he'd be tied to.
Exactly, but it still establishes it. That would be the common sense thing to do
mm-hmm.
is trust the police to do their jobs rather than doing this running and hiding and covering up, because it just makes you look fucking guilty.
Yeah, and hiding out in Owen's house.
Yes.
I did like where Owen's getting frustrated and
with the tea. Yes,
with the tea. So, you know, he invites the police into the house, realizing that his mom's still alive, damn it.
Yeah.
And he's getting a little irritated by it. So he's like, well, they're here to question me about my teacher.
There is a great bit where he sticks his head into the pantry and he goes, he sees Larry and goes, hi. And the look on Billy Crystal's face is like,
what?
Yeah.
He's like, no, hi, T. I like to say hi to things.
Yes. Making Owen look even more special.
Yes. I would have probably changed the line to, hi, T. That's what we call it in England.
Exactly.
The mother country.
Right. I mean, the rest of the scene was clumsy, mm-hmm. right? With the, well, can you give me this tea? Oh, no, I have some here. Oh, can you give me this? Oh, no, I have some here. No, I changed my mind. I want this instead. Clumsy, clumsy, clumsy. But yeah.
Yeah, it never comes off funny.
No.
It doesn't really create tension.
No. No, like most of this movie, some of the things that were supposed to create tension didn't quite land. I mean, you could see what they were trying to do, but mm-hmm. it didn't quite land for me.
Yeah. Well, even like the rigged door, they were going to try to rig an accident.
Yeah.
So, you know, mom always hangs her house coat on this hook leading to the basement. So they took out the hinges on hinge pins on the door, hoping that she would fall down. It doesn't make a lot of sense because you're not putting any weight on the door.
Billy was supposed to push her into it, I think, because Larry was supposed to put like sort of bump her into it so that she would hit the door and then go down.
Right.
But, of course, it doesn't work because of another comedy of errors.
Yeah, well, it wound up being a bit of a Wile E. Coyote moment where nothing happens, and then he's like, huh, presses on the door, and then he goes down with it and then takes a header into the water heater.
Yes, and another thing that made this, that kind of took away from this film is there's some great witty dialogue,
mm-hmm.
right? But then there's also...
Oh, and your friend's dead. Get him, go bury him in the backyard before he starts making a smell.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm like, whoa, what is with your mom?
Yeah,
like,
she's a cold woman.
That is improper disposal of a body.
Yes. Yeah, it's like, well, if your friend died accidentally, then you call the police.
Again, yeah.
Call the police. Call the police. Call the police.
Yeah.
That's what their job is.
Yeah, especially this person. Well, I guess she didn't know he was the accused murderer yet.
No, at this point she didn't. But yeah, there's all these moments where you've got sort of this really witty dialogue, and then you have something that takes away from it with the sort of this visual comedy, right? And visual comedy can work, but sometimes when you have really great dialogue, you shouldn't mess it up with visual comedy, to me. And that's,
but the problem is neither, they didn't really have either.
They had moments of great dialogue.
There's definitely moments.
Yeah. But the visual comedy didn't compensate for the weakness of the dialogue either, right? Because the visual comedy was kind of weak too, for the most part. The end scene where they're holding mom upside down at the back of the train there, that was kind of funny.
Yeah. And she's running down the train. There's a murderer on the train. There's a murderer on the train.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, considering the movie's called Throw Mama from the Train.
Yeah, you don't get the train until right at the end.
Until right at
but
the
you
end.
Know what? It's Strangers on a Train, and that train is the first 10 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, so they just moved it to the end instead, but
yeah.
Right. But yeah, it, I mean, on the whole, I mean, I see what they're trying to do, and I would say, like, in terms of quality of film, they're on par, right? Mm. I mean, you've got sort of a mediocre thriller and a mediocre comedy.
Yeah, I wouldn't, at this stage, I definitely wouldn't put Danny DeVito at Alfred Hitchcock's directorial capabilities.
No, not by any means.
Any means at all. I mean, rating-wise, these don't come close in my mind. Okay, yeah, I wasn't fond of either one of these, but yeah, Strangers on a Train, heads and tails above Throw Mama from a Train, for sure.
As far as filmmaking, yes.
Yeah, the filmmaker in me is very happy watching this movie, but there's definitely times where I'm getting really annoyed with Bruno and some of the dialogue. I'm like, and just the situations where they're just not making a lot of sense.
Yeah, and that's what I mean in terms of storytelling quality. There, I would put them on par.
Yeah, IMDb gives Strangers on a Train 8.0 out of 10, and Rotten Tomatoes gives it a whopping 98% critic score and 92% audience score.
You know, sometimes maybe we just don't get what other people do because
we don't have the nostalgia behind us, right?
That's true. And
I mean, I keep saying this all the time where nostalgia really drives our, and we get, or trust me, sometimes I see it in the comments sometimes where, especially on YouTube, where they're not getting what we're doing, but when we discuss these movies and, or they don't agree with us, but it's like, having done this many of these at this point, I'm like, you kind of have to take nostalgia out of it to make a proper judgment.
Yeah. And like I said, and we're not belittling the film in the sense that it's not a worthwhile film to watch. It's just
absolutely is a worthwhile film to watch because it influenced so much.
Yeah, and there are great qualities about it, but on the whole, it is definitely not Hitchcock's best work.
No,
and I'm not sure that it deserves a 98%.
No, again, I think people are being a little too precious about Alfred Hitchcock in general. Yeah. In this, like, he this is not one of his better movies. I mean, I wouldn't call it a stinker.
No, it's definitely not a stinker.
But I wouldn't call it a bad movie. I mean, I'm sure it was absolutely fantastic in 1951. Mm-hmm. Just there's so much of it as far as evolution of storytelling that just doesn't work anymore.
Exactly.
Now, Throw Mom from a Train has a 6.2 out of 10 on IMDb and a 62% critic score, so bang even, and a 54% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes.
And I'm comfortable with those. I think that's about right for Throw Mama.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would still, Stranger to Train, I would definitely rate higher than that.
Just for the filmmaking more than anything else.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's, because it's, again, it is an absolutely beautiful watch.
Yeah.
Right? As far as visually, I still think.
And there's some good performances in there. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think Patricia Hitchcock was pretty great. I think Alfred Hitchcock's concerns about Ruth Roman were well-placed.
Yes.
She does come off a bit stiff. But at the same time, you're not going to get a great performance out of somebody you're tormenting on set.
And that might be a self-fulfilling prophecy there.
Yeah. Robert Walker as Bruno. I guess, like, he likes characters like this. And I see what he was trying to do there. But again, I think that was problems in the script. That where I did not take to his character, but I'm not supposed to. He's the bad guy.
He is the bad guy.
I liked Farley Granger quite a bit, though.
Yes, I did too. I think that he played his character exactly the way he needed to be played.
Yeah.
This is, yes, performances, filmmaking. I would give it that 98%. Storytelling, I would give it maybe a 73, 74%.
Yeah, I think I'm right in the same ballpark with you. Okay. Any last thoughts about these? It was kind of fun to compare something so like fundamentally a little different, but samey at the same time. Well, I mean, I can remember Simpsons episodes and South Park. I mean, you probably remember all sorts of TV episodes that are inspired by Strangers on a Train. So
certainly, and there's other films as you mentioned. You know, I'm glad we did it. Mm-hmm. Because this is one that's sort of been on my...
It's been a while since we've done something like this. We did that with The Hand episode.
With The Hand and then the Airplane.
Airplane as yeah. well.
And it was 0 Hour was the one, right?
Yeah, 0 Hour.
Right, that one was almost... interestingly enough, it's like...
They're really close.
They are really
just,
close.
It just shows you where a tonal shift can completely change a movie.
Exactly. Whereas this one here is it's definitely more inspired by...
Yeah.
Rather than a straight up remake.
Yeah, and the reason we chose this one is basically because of the train motifs. Make them a little closer than some of the other ones that were inspired by it.
Exactly. And I had forgotten that they actually watched the film in the movie because I've only seen it once prior to this myself. But I think that just sort of reemphasized the purpose of choosing this particular one because it was quite honest about the fact that it was an homage to and inspired by Strangers on a Train.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm glad I finally saw Strangers on a Train because it was one of the Hitchcock films that I haven't seen.
You know, I wasn't, and to be fair, I still don't know if I'd seen it or not. I watched a lot of old black and whites with my family and my grandmother when I was young, and I don't remember all of them, but I certainly remembered that final scene with the carousel.
Yeah.
So I have seen bits of it, if nothing else.
Well, and yeah, the carousel scene, I mean, I know I've seen it in clip shows where they're talking about Hitchcock's work or sort of classic thriller films. So, I mean, in all else failed, I know I've seen at least parts of it, but I know I've never seen the movie in its entirety until this viewing.
Mm-hmm. Right? Ironically, that entire scene was stripped fairly faithfully from a different book. That nobody got credited for because the novel ends very differently, apparently.
I'm interested to see how her other works have translated, right? Because, like I said, she's the author of the Ripley novels, which, I mean, when you look, you can kind of see that, right? You have this manipulative character who tries to twist things to his own purpose. And then that Cry of the Owl that I mentioned earlier as well, what I was gathering is there's some of that happening in those novels as well. So that sort of seems to be her theme is characters that seem well-balanced initially actually are completely unbalanced.
Right.
So I'm interested to sort of review at least that Cry of the Owl at some point. But as far as these movies go, I'm happy to have done them. I don't know that I'll ever watch either of them again.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you there. I could maybe see myself revisiting the Hitchcock, possibly, but I don't ever really want to see Throw Mama from the Train again.
It's funny, is because Val normally watches at least one of our movies with me so she can do the video trigger. She did not this week due to some other commitments. But when we first were talking about it, she says, well, I'll watch Strangers on a Train because I fucking hate Throw Mama from the Train. So she remembered not liking it. So there's that. And that's about as much as you're going to get for future.
Fair enough. That's pretty good, though. Oh, the horror. We're going to HorrorCon again this year. Hopefully we'll get some good coverage for you. And you should go to HorrorCon, too. HorrorCon is in Calgary on June 22nd and 23rd with a VIP party happening on the 21st that you can also attend and buy tickets towards. We had a lot of fun last year going to HorrorCon and getting some interviews and just walking around and being horror fans as well. So we highly recommend you hit it up if you're in the Calgary area in June. You can buy your tickets online or at my shop, Words and Pictures, here in Calgary, and all Video Game Trader locations as well. Special guests are featuring guys like Jason himself, Kane Hodder, Edwin Neal from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. A lot of Texas Chainsaw Massacre guests this year, so if you're a Texas Chainsaw fan, you want to check it out because Bill freaking Moseley's going to be there.
Yes, we're going to gush later. We gushed last week. I think we gushed the week before. No gushing this week. Just Bill Moseley. Fucking Moseley.
Yeah, and then there's Danny Lloyd from The Shining, and CJ Graham, another Jason, is going to be there.
And we did interview last year.
We did talk to him last year. So don't expect it to happen again this year. I like to mix it up. Bob Elmore, Alex Vincent from the Chucky movies, and Christine Elise from the Chucky film franchise as well as 90210 and ER.
strange transition. Well, not really. A lot of people get their sort of start in horror and then they move on to other things, right?
Sure. It's not all horror for every actor.
Yeah.
So go check that out. That's June 21st through the 23rd here in Calgary at the Clarion Hotel.
Yes. It was a fun time last year.
And we can also get you some sweet deals on some other tickets. Go to seatgiant.ca or seatgiant.com and check out the plethora of tickets they have available for sporting events like NFL football and Major League Baseball, and the NHL playoffs are starting to wrap up. But you can go on there and check out some sweet deals there, concerts and plays and all sorts of cool stuff. Grab your tickets at seatgiant.ca and .com, and at checkout, use our promo code INVASION. That's, again, INVASION, and you can get an extra discount on those tickets. So check it out. Seat Giant, they're a game changer. All right, well, any last thoughts on Throw Mama from the Train and Strangers on a Train and other trains? Trains in general.
Trains in general? I haven't been on a train in years, not in any hurry. Just like I'm not in any hurry to watch any of the movies again.
Mom, if you're listening, can I please? She's got this amazing train set that she's had forever, and she's never let us touch it. Me and my brother. And I want to build it so badly, because it's an electric train set.
A classic electric train set.
Yeah, and it's got the trees and the buildings, and I want to put it together.
It's probably worth a fortune now.
Probably is. I don't even know what brand it is, so you train enthusiasts, that might bug me. I don't know. I don't have any answers for you.
Yeah, but I mean, if she's had it for since we're a kid, then yeah, it's probably a collector's item of some sort, and it's never been set up?
Nope. I think a little bits and pieces got set up. I do remember some of it being out, but... very rarely.
Yeah, I can imagine so.
It was I'm setting it up, I'll show it to you, keep your hands off of it.
So, moms and their toys.
Yeah, that's a train I'd like to throw her off of.
Oh.
She wouldn't go very far. It's, no. It's a tiny little train.
It is a tiny little train.
So it doesn't sound as bad when you put it into perspective and visualize
force
it.
Perspective.
Force perspective. There you go. The force perspective. We've wrapped it back around.
Because we do shit like that.
I don't want to force your perspective by throwing you over to our social media sites. If you're not following us on our social media, what the hell's wrong with you? We're at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion the Remake at gmail.com. When you're over at iTunes and your other platforms, do us a favor. Drop a 5-star and a short review. That would be great.
We'd love that.
That'd be a nice little gift for the free podcast we've been giving to you for nearly 200 episodes. We're getting there. We're getting there, folks. The countdown to 200 is starting to happen.
Yeah, yikes.
Right?
That's... mind-boggling, because that's an episode every single week, and that does not include special episodes.
Yeah, those Christmas little specials that we drop. No, that our episode number and counting only numbering happens on full episodes. So, holy crap!
That's a lot of content for free.
So you know, give us a little thank you by giving us a 5-star rating and a short review over on iTunes. That would definitely help. And you can also tell your friends where to find this show as well. Help that audience grow and spread the invasion. We're on, of course, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, TuneIn Radio, Player FM, Blueberry, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and even frickin' YouTube. Frickin' you, son of a... We're over there, too. We drop every Tuesday over on all the podcast platforms, and every Thursday over on YouTube, just to annoy the YouTube people, to drive them over to the Tuesday crowd. Not the best platform for us, if you want to listen to an audio platform, but that's fine. If you want to stare at a picture for an hour and a half to 2 hours listening to our fine, sultry, and sometimes moist and humid voices, that's fine.
Humid, moist. Who is it? One of our friends is made uncomfortable by the word moist. I think it's Dooley.
Oh, I think you're right. I think Dooley had a problem with moist, because it's hard to say moist without your mouth being moist.
Yes, and it's just something about the word made him uncomfortable just to begin with. I'm not sure why.
There's an underlying problem we will have to solve.
Or not.
Or not. Maybe not.
If you're listening, Mike, we love you. We miss you. Moist.
He misses you and it makes him moist.
Moist. Should I say that? Moist.
Oh, see, now I see why he has a problem with it.
Because I'm cruel?
Because the way you say it.
Yes.
All right, well, we're getting off this train. Ba-dum bump. Until next week, I've been Jason.
And I am always Sam.
And we are out of here.
Mrs. Lift?
Get away from me, you horse's ass!
She's not a woman.